From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Art Spiegelman won a Pulitzer Prize for Mouse, his comic book rendering of the Holocaust, in which he drew Jews as mice and Germans as cats. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Spiegelman about his new book. He's just illustrated the 1928 hard-boiled poem, The Wild Party. Also, we meet self-proclaimed bad girl and feminist Nicole Panter. She managed the punk band The Germs, worked with the sick and poor in India, got paid to talk dirty for phone sex, co-founded the Bohemian Women's Political Alliance, and now she has a new book of stories. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new release by Dutch pianist Misha Mengelberg, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Madonna's latest album, Bedtime Stories. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali will go to Sarajevo tomorrow to seek a ceasefire agreement that he hopes will salvage the UN peace mission in Bosnia, NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports.
A UN spokesman in Zagreb said Boutros-Ghali will go to Sarajevo with rock-bottom conditions for the continued presence of UN troops in the region. Michael Williams said these are extremely difficult days for the UN mission, but he added, "We are not at the stage of ultimatums yet." He said Boutros-Ghali would seek a ceasefire throughout Bosnia and an end to the restrictions, harassment, and detention of 500 peacekeepers by Serb forces. In response to questions about the wave of criticism poured on the UN for its failure to protect the besieged safe haven of Bihać, Williams said the UN troops had been given the task of a peacekeeping operation where there is no peace to keep. Meanwhile, U.S. and European diplomats reached out to Bosnian Serbs, offering them the possibility of a confederation with Serbia, a move that has thus far been rejected as rewarding Serbian aggression. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Zagreb.
Countries that have been promising financial aid to the Palestinians are meeting in Brussels to try to get some self-rule projects moving and show Palestinians that with peace comes prosperity. Economic conditions have been blamed as underlying causes of recent violence in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Palestinian self-rule in those areas was planned last year, with donors pledging more than $2 billion over 5 years to support the Palestinian administration. But a senior World Bank official says only about $240 million is being disbursed this year. PLO Chief Yasser Arafat is in Brussels, and he's told the delegates to the conference that the international community has a moral and political responsibility to the Palestinians. The Postal Rate Commission will decide tomorrow on whether to raise the cost of mailing a first-class letter. NPR's Melinda Pankava has this report.
If the Rate Commission goes along with the Postal Service's request, first-class mail would require a 32-cent stamp, and all mail would face a 10.3% hike as of January 1st. According to the Washington Post, that's a boon for magazine companies and other bulk mailers, which had been wary of a bigger increase. Critics say higher rates are needed for some categories of mail in order to deal with an $8 billion deficit and fix lagging service. An estimated $4.7 billion could be raised with a 32-cent stamp and the 10.3% across-the-board hike. It needs the blessing of the Postal Rate Commission, which is to state its position tomorrow. As a hedge, the Postal Service has already printed stamps with the letter G on them to be used until it gets the final go-ahead on what price the new stamps will carry. I'm Melinda Pankava in Washington.
In stock trading, the Dow is down 5 points. The Nasdaq is up 4 points. This is NPR News. A survey of American households finds consumer confidence at a four-year high. The business research group, the Conference Board, says its monthly index jumped from 89 in October to 101 in November. The group's report says consumers are considerably more positive about current conditions and even more optimistic about the next 6 months. It may soon be possible for consumers to go to a national bank to apply for a mortgage or other new services. The agency that regulates nationally chartered banks is considering a proposal to make it easier for bank subsidiaries to enter new areas of business. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Subsidiaries of nationally chartered banks have long sought to get into such areas as real estate and other financial services, and now the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency wants to make it easier for banks to do so. The agency will consider bank requests to offer new services on a case-by-case basis. Agency spokeswoman Lee Cross says they're not making any representation about what activities they might approve. Under current regulations, subsidiaries of nationally chartered banks can only do those things that banks do unless there is a specific exemption. The Comptroller's Office is proposing a process whereby subsidiaries could go ahead with a new activity as long as it is part of the business of banking or incidental to the business of banking. But Cross says the new proposal doesn't mean they're giving banks carte blanche. The proposed regulations are subject to 60 days of public comment and will be followed by a review period by the Comptroller's staff. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A British couple convicted of buying a baby in Romania and trying to smuggle her out of the country left Romania for England today. Bernadette and Adrian Mooney's convictions stand, but an appeals court overturned their 28-month jail sentences. Mrs. Mooney says she and her husband cannot adopt the child they tried to smuggle out of Romania because of their criminal records. The couple is going home with another child they adopted legally in 1991. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Art Spiegelman, creates comic books for adults on themes that are usually tackled by serious fiction. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his comic book Mouse, which told two complex stories, how his father survived the Holocaust and what it was like for Spiegelman to be the son of a troubled, paranoid survivor. Art Spiegelman also founded Raw Magazine, which showcased the work of avant-garde comic book and graphic artists. In the past couple of years, he's done several cover illustrations for the New Yorker magazine. Now he's illustrated a book-length poem from 1928 called The Wild Party, which Spiegelman describes as a lost classic, a hard-boiled jazz-age tragedy told in syncopated rhyming couplets. His illustrations are inspired by pulp fiction, German expressionism, and comic books. William Burroughs says The Wild Party is the poem that made him want to be a writer. I asked Spiegelman to read the opening of this poem, written by Joseph Moncure March.
Queenie was a blonde, and her age stood still, and she danced twice a day in vaudeville. Gray eyes, lips like coals aglow, her face was a tinted mask of snow. What hips, what shoulders, what a back she had. Her legs were built to drive men mad, and she did. She would skid, but sooner or later they bored her. 16 a year was her order. They might be blackguards, they might be curs, they might be actors, sports, chauffeurs. She never inquired of the men she desired about their social status or wealth. She was only concerned about their health. True, she knew. There was little she hadn't been through. And she liked her lovers violent and vicious. Queenie was sexually ambitious. So, now you know. A fascinating woman as they go. She lived at present with a man named Burrs whose act came on just after hers. A clown of renown. Three-sheeted all over town. He was comical as sin, comical as hell. A gesture, a grin, and the house would yell, uproarious. He was glorious. So from the front. People in the wings saw him and thought of other things coldly, most coldly. Many would say them boldly, adding in language without much lace, they'd like to break his goddamn face. Ask why? They might be stuck. They'd like to, just for luck. But these were men for the greater part. A woman would offer him up her heart, throbbing, on a platter. He could bite it, and it wouldn't matter. As long as he kissed and held her tight and gave her a fairly hectic night, which he could and would, a man these women understood. Oh, yes, Burrs was a charming fellow, brutal with women and proportionately yellow. Once he had been forced into a marriage. Unlucky girl, she had a miscarriage 2 days later. Possibly due to the fact that Burrs beat her with the heel of a shoe till her lips went blue. For a week, her brother had great fun looking for Burrs with a snub-nosed gun, at the end of which time she began to recover. And Burrs, having vanished, the thing blew over. Just a sample, for example. One is probably ample.
How did you first discover the poem?
Well, it was part of rummaging around used bookstores, which has always been my version of tranquilizers, just whenever things are going too weird and crazy, I spend a day in a bookstore. And what made this unusual is I usually have better fare to hunt through than the poetry sections. It's not where I usually find what I'm interested in. And this, because it had a very nicely designed spine typography, made me pull it out, open it up, and find a frontispiece by Reginald Marsh. And he's an artist I've always enjoyed and admired, even though he's not in great modernist repute. And opened the poem, started reading it, and found myself reading it all the way through and saying, oh, this is poetry I can deal with. I like this. And then just figured someday I'd like to draw it. And the someday finally came about 20 years later.
Now, let's look at one of the illustrations from the passage that we just heard. There's a part that describes how she had a miscarriage because her boyfriend beat her with the heel of a shoe till her lips went blue. And describe the picture that you've come up with for that.
Okay, well, let's see. Seen across the bottom part of spread of the two pages, there's a three-quarter rear view of Burrs with a heel of a shoe in his, with a shoe in his hand ready to strike. A young woman in a brief nightgown is protecting her face while she's lying on a bed. And superimposed on the picture is a clipping from an old Sears Roebuck catalog of shoes from the period, showing that you can get either the spike heel or the Cuban style heel for the shoe.
Yeah, this is an ad for lustrous black patent leather pumps. Choice of Cuban or spike heel. Why did you put that little ad in?
Oh, partially to acknowledge my sources, because I was doing a lot of steeping myself in the period in order to get the details right. And partially just to pull some distance away from what would otherwise be a brutalizing action.
You write in your introduction that you confess to a powerful nostalgia for all decades that precede your birth. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I'm sure it's a yearning for an innocence that never was.
Well, you're not going to find innocence in hard-boiled stuff or in German Expressionism.
Oh, I guess, although I find that this book has a kind of curdled innocence, I guess is the phrase that keeps coming to my mind. That the message, insofar as there is a moral or a message in this book, probably is one can't afford to be innocent. And yet there is a kind of pleasurable, wide-open eagerness for the decadent thrills that are coming through in this book.
Tell us something about the author Joseph Moncure March.
Well, it turns out he was the first Jesus at the New Yorker, the Jesus being the managing editor who was meant to save the place from chaos. And he lasted about a year. But he brought in, among other people, I think E.B. White indirectly into the magazine. And he was he'd gone to prep school with Reginald Marsh, incidentally, which is how he got to get Marsh to do the illustrations. They were seated alphabetically next to each other. And lived in New York, wanted to be a writer. He was more or less being supported by his father, who was a businessman, and was willing to support him as long as he could prove he really was a writer. So in the summer of 1926, he took time out from his wild parties to make this book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Art Spiegelman. In his graphic novel, Mouse, won a Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called The Wild Party. It's his illustrations for a poem that was written in 1928 by Joseph Moncure March. What was it like for you when Mouse ended? You'd worked on that for years, and it came out in installments in your magazine, Raw. And then there were, what, two books worth of Mouse that came out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was one book separated before birth, but the first part came out in 86 and the second part in 92.
Okay, and then it was over. You finished it after years and years of work. What did you turn to after that? And what did it feel like when it was finished?
Well, on the one hand, I felt thoroughly confused by the success and acclaim the book had had, and rather scared of the demands that were beginning to be made on me, demands to become a spokesperson for the second generation
of Holocaust survivors,
and to become an ongoing, Eli Wiesel of the comic book or something, and that terrified me. I didn't want to be a spokesperson for anything, and there were essentially the questions that would come my way would be: so when is Mouse 3 coming out? As if this was an endless story, like Blondie and Dagwood, with Dagwood still running after his bus 50 years later. And it was necessary for me just to keep sane, to be able to find other territory that was pleasurable for me to explore. And I think that's why The Wild Party came back into my head. I mean, here was a book with no cats, no mice, virtually no Jews, politically incorrect, no saving graces except the pleasures of the rhythms of the poem, a chance to do something that was decorative rather than as austere as Mao's had to be in order to not create a lapse in judgment and taste. And in some ways, it was chosen primarily as a not-mouse.
Let me add something to that in the not-mouse category. There were no members of your family in the book. This was not a book that was personal about your relationship with your father.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to kind of go out and deal with sex and death in forums outside the family drama.
Now, what was it like for you to go after so many years of working in the underground, you know, of having this devoted but really small audience, to winning a Pulitzer Prize, getting reviewed all over, and being acclaimed?
Well, it still unhinges me a bit. I know there are all these people from movie studios who keep contacting me wanting to make a movie out of Mouse. That still goes on now. And this producer calls up and says, we want to bring your work to a wide audience. And I think of like 300,000 or 400,000 people as a rather good-sized audience, actually. And he thinks of it as a cult book as he's talking to me from his Hollywood office.
Would you be interested in making a movie out of Mouse?
Not at all. No, I can't. When I was asked to do this, usually I don't have to have this conversation. It's my agent who fends this off for me. But somebody found their way through to me from creative artists and said, you don't understand, we'll give you complete creative control. And I said, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I just don't know how it should be made into a movie. Last time I thought about this, I thought we should use real mice.
And what, you train them?
I was interested in having these like screen tests with mice talking, you know, but I told him to get back to me when he could arrange it.
What happened to Raw Magazine?
It's on ice, basically, because in some ways, the things that became possible for me after Mouse, including, hey, I want to illustrate The Wild Party, and the publisher says, sure, that sounds good. What's The Wild Party? Opened up other things that I wanted to do and took time away. For another thing, a number of the cartoonists who were part of that generation of Raw artists have found their way into other venues, so it became less urgent to do a magazine to present their work. So that at this point, Charles Burns's work, a fellow Philadelphian of yours, appears on the cover of Time magazine, and he has plenty of publishers interested in doing his comics. Same thing is true for Gary Panter, who did the sets for the Pee Wee Herman show. Same thing is true for Sue Coe, whose work is appearing all around town, and so on. And the comic scene isn't quite as bleak as it was in 1980 when we started Raw. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it, I suppose, is that The New Yorker came along and offered an opportunity for the other half of Raw, Françoise Mouly, my wife, to be the art editor, and has given me and a number of other Raw artists pages to work on there.
My guest is comic book artist Art Spiegelman. In his new book, The Wild Party, he illustrates a 1928 hard-boiled poem. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic book artist Art Spiegelman. You had a cover in The New Yorker on Valentine's Day of 93.
Yes.
And this was a very controversial cover. It was a male Hasidic Jew embracing and kissing with an African-American woman.
Mm-hmm.
And this was during the period of a lot of friction, not that friction has stopped, but of a lot of friction in New York City between blacks and Hasidic Jews.
Yeah, it was in the wake
in
of Crown Heights.
Yeah. And you got some pretty hostile reaction to that cover.
I sure did. Well, for instance, in the New York Times, there's an op-ed page piece describing, with horror, this cover and describing the Jews' lascivious lips. And then in the Washington Post, there was another op-ed piece that described the Jews' prim lips. And that gave me a clue as to the objection to this image. It had to do with the fact that Jews might have lips, because I couldn't draw lips that were simultaneously prim and lascivious otherwise. And then I found that there was, some spokesperson for the black community was complaining that I had drawn a black woman one more time being oppressed by white men. And why hadn't I drawn a black man kissing a white woman? To which I pointed out to this reverend that he might be a good reverend, but he was a rotten art director. It's much harder to show a Hasidic woman in an instant than a Hasidic man. And that in any case, the stereotypes run deep. All I would have really accomplished is a stereotype of the black, rapacious, sexual male rapist. So that the stereotypes were the problem. The imagery underlying the racial problem were the problem, not the cover. But I was, I did it feeling I'd conjured up a messianic image of peace, if anything, and knew that it was more appropriate for April Fool's Day than Valentine's Day when I presented it, and ultimately was kind of gratified by the response, because if it got the black community and the Hasidic community angry at me, at least they had a common enemy now.
You have a recent cover in The New Yorker from September 26, 1994. And the cover illustration is of a rather prim-looking middle-aged woman who's waiting for a bus. And there's one of those really large posters at the bus stop, and the poster is for men's underwear. And so there's this really large male bikini-clad crotch in this underwear ad that she's both looking at and trying to avoid at the same time.
Right, it's a bus shelter, but it's not very sheltering somehow.
Yeah, she looks very embarrassed by the whole thing. And so the advertisement reads Briefs, and you've titled the cartoon Brief Encounter.
Right.
So what made you think about doing this cover of a...
Well, let's see. Part of it is that I rarely go out of the house. And then I did one day, and it ended up in Times Square.
Uh-huh.
And then looming over Times Square is an 8-story-high Calvin Klein's male crotch, Blade Runner-like, hovering over the city. And I found it really oppressive. So I went home, identified thoroughly with this Helen Hokuson-like middle-aged woman, and came up with this image. Much to my surprise, everything that comes around goes around. So a month later, I did a cover for the New Yorker's fashion issue, which was a drawing of a fashion runway and a model in, I don't remember the designer's name, Blahnik shoes, walking down the runway as a bunch of naked reporters and paparazzi photographers sit in the audience. And that cover got turned into an 8-story-high Sony billboard right next to the Calvin Klein poster to oppress other people and inspire yet more covers in the future by somebody else, I suppose.
How odd. Now, you said you rarely go out of your apartment.
That's still true, yeah.
Well, why?
It's dangerous out there. I don't know. I mean, cartooning, drawing, writing, it's very labor-intensive, quiet activity, so I find it just takes up most of my day. And I do go out for cigarettes, and I now work in a studio 3 blocks from the house, so I do have those 3 blocks. And I did get mugged once walking those 3 blocks, but for the most part, it's a fairly safe 3 blocks, and I stay there.
What happened to you when you got mugged?
Actually, it was just... let's see, what happened? So I'm walking home. It's a very quiet 3 blocks, 8 o'clock at night. And I'd learned my street smarts a generation earlier. There were three rather unsavory-looking young black men sitting on a stoop, and I had to figure out what to do. I could no longer turn around and run, I felt. And I figured I should just walk past and keep my eyes straight ahead, which was the way one would do it in 1970, when I did go out of the house. And... it seems that now that's no longer a good idea, because this was, as the cop told me later, a way of them perceiving that I was dissing them by not feeling threatened, where obviously they were threatening. So I was supposed to cross over warily and continue walking, they said. So I didn't, walked by, and then one person goes, "Yo, what are you looking at?" and then whacks me on the back of the head with a board, and that knocks my glasses off, which I'd forgotten to remove from when I was writing and drawing. And instead of running or walking away, I started looking for my glasses, which got him really angry at me. And he picked up a Coke bottle, at which point I figured it was time to go away and get my glasses later. So it wasn't even a mugging that led to permanent damage other than a bump on my head or to money being taken or anything like that. It was just sort of something to remind me that that these are dangerous times.
Now, because you're so... I'm interested in this because you're so interested in crime fiction and in illustrations from crime fiction. So did any images stick with you? Of course, you probably couldn't even see without your glasses.
No, I could, because they're just for reading. No, mainly what I saw was stars, so I drew some. You know, like that's...
Did you really see stars?
Yeah, it was a good solid whack to the back of the head. So I got... I mean, I think in cartoon imagery, I suppose, so that maybe I wouldn't have seen stars unless I'd already been primed that that's what you see after you get whacked on the head. But there they were.
What are some of the other things that you think you experience as comic book images?
Oh, let's see. When somebody's mumbling and talking really softly, I see a speech balloon above their head with letters that I can barely read. that's one. And when seeing some member of my family close up, little kind of hearts might appear, you know. It's animated cartoon images as well. And primarily, I suppose, it's when I think back on events, you know, that I think of them in terms of panel one, panel two, and I get to edit out the uninteresting stuff that would happen in between.
Art Spiegelman, his new book, The Wild Party, brings together a 1928 poem by Joseph Moncure March with Spiegelman's illustrations. In Holland, Misha Mengelberg composes for and conducts his 8-piece ICP orchestra. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says his only problem with this great band is that there's little room for Mengelberg's piano playing. Last winter, Mengelberg came to New York to record with an American rhythm section, playing some of his straight-ahead jazz tunes.
Misha Mengelberg says, "When I grasp for something in improvisation, it must be something living that I don't understand." Misha Mengelberg came through the 60s art movement known as Fluxus, partly dedicated to upsetting the bourgeoisie. He claims he went to the conservatory to learn the rules to break. His piano heroes are Duke Ellington, Herbie Nichols, and Thelonious Monk. Nowadays, most pianists who play like Monk try to make him sound normal. Misha loves the plink of Monk's music and knows how to replicate it. But he uses those techniques to his own ends. The heart in his music wins you over, but it can take a minute. Trio format on Misha Mengelberg's CD, Whose Bridge, from the Avant label, puts his piano in the foreground, which doesn't happen much with his own band. Back home in Holland, he likes musicians who disrupt the music and subvert his plans. His American allies, bassist Brad Jones and drummer Joey Barron, may be a little too cooperative. Once or twice, Misha revolts against the polite way they keep time for him. On the other hand, they keep his attention from wandering, which can happen, and he does play great. If you love serious jazz piano and catchy tunes, you really should check this CD out.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He reviewed Whose Bridge by the Misha Mengelberg Trio on Avant. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nicole Panter is a self-proclaimed bad girl and feminist. She managed the punk band The Germs, was a topless dancer, co-founded the Bohemian Women's Political Alliance, and was a founding member of Pee Wee's Playhouse. She's part of a literary world she describes as governed by the rules of punk rock. Coming up, we'll talk with her, and she'll read from her new collection of short stories, Mr. Right On. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews bedtime stories by the bad girl of pop, Madonna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. House members are holding a rare lame duck session today to vote on the GATT World Trade Agreement. Supporters are predicting victory. NPR's John Idstey reports.
The Clinton administration couldn't get a vote on the new GATT before the election, so the old Congress is coming back for a special session to consider the trade pact. Republicans appear ready to back the measure strongly in the House. And though there's been some erosion in Democratic support, the historic trade agreement is expected to pass the House today. The outcome in the Senate on Thursday is less certain. The new GATT would lower tariffs by about 40% on manufactured goods, and for the first time bring trade in services and agricultural products under world trade rules. It creates protections against the piracy of intellectual property such as films, computer software, and drug formulas. Most controversial is the agreement's creation of the new World Trade Organization with enhanced power to settle trade disputes. Opponents say it threatens U.S. sovereignty. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the U.S. will propose new talks between the warring factions in Bosnia, leading to a possible international conference. And the U.N. Secretary General is expected to arrive in Sarajevo tomorrow to appeal to the Serbs to accept a peace agreement. The Serbs have rejected previous international peace efforts, which have required the Serbs to give up territory. But State Department spokesman Mike McCurry says he still believes the Serbs might accept such a deal now.
Our judgment is that the Bosnian Serbs have some very compelling reasons to want this war to come to an end. They have people who want to get on with their lives as well. And they know they can't. They know they face a fairly relentless regime of economic sanctions, and they face the isolation they would face as outcasts in the international community if they didn't bring the war to an end.
Some reports have said international mediators will offer to accept a confederation between the Bosnian Serbs and the Republic of Serbia. But U.S. Envoy Charles Thomas says the mediators will offer the same plan the Serbs rejected in August. Former Vice President Dan Quayle is being treated at an Indiana hospital for a blood clot in one lung. Quayle was admitted complaining of shortness of breath. A hospital spokeswoman says doctors are pleased with the progress he's been making.
His condition is still being evaluated by his doctors, who have already begun treatment for the blood clot. Mr. Quayle's condition is stable. At this time, his physicians anticipate that Mr. Quayle's hospitalization will be approximately 1 week and that he will have complete recovery.
Quayle had been expected to announce a run for the presidency soon. The head of his political action committee says it's uncertain when the former vice president will be able to return to his normal schedule. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1 point to close at 37.38. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. This is NPR. The Israeli army says it has arrested 40 suspected guerrillas of the Islamic militant group Hamas in connection with the Tel Aviv bus bombing. The suicide attack last month killed more than 20 people. The army says overall it has arrested 400 Palestinians in a crackdown on Hamas since the bombing. But it has not picked up a fugitive nicknamed the Engineer, who is thought to have been the mastermind. Hamas has been staging attacks to protest the Israeli PLO peace agreement. In Berlin, there were groundbreaking ceremonies today for the reconstruction of a World War II landmark, especially popular with American tourists. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Kaisers and kings once hobnobbed at Berlin's legendary Hotel Adlon, where Marlene Dietrich began her career. Frequent guests included film stars Charlie Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks. The hotel launched an afternoon dance tea with jazz music to cater to the frequent American tourists. It was one of the few buildings to survive Allied bombing raids in World War II. Shortly after the war ended, it was destroyed by fire. A group of private investors have raised more than $200 million to rebuild the hotel on its historic site near the Brandenburg Gate by the spring of 1997. At the ceremonies, City Mayor Richard Diepgen said in the hotel's heyday, Berliners like to say, if you didn't know Hotel Adlon, you didn't know Berlin. I'm Dieter Berger reporting.
A survey finds that business forecasters expect slower economic growth and moderate inflation next year. The National Association of Business Economists polled 47 professional forecasters earlier this month. The consensus that emerged is for economic growth of about 1 percentage point down from the final numbers projected for this year. And the economists predict inflation for next year will be up about 1 point from this year's level. They also forecast little growth in paychecks and continued easing of unemployment. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nicole Panther has described herself as a bad girl and feminist. Her resume is an unlikely combination of sex, politics, literature, and rock and roll. In the late 70s, she managed the notorious L.A. punk band The Germs. She was a founding member and writer of Pee Wee's Playhouse. She worked at a hospice for the dying in Calcutta, and for a while made a living in the States, working as a topless dancer and doing phone sex. All of these occupations and preoccupations are evident in her new book, Mr. Right On, and other stories. We invited her for an interview and reading. The reading is an excerpt of the story Mr. Right On, which details the adventures of an idealistic but somewhat naive feminist activist who's picked up at a conference by a fellow panelist. He's an older, well-known academic liberal. He seduces her during dinner.
You're so lucky to be a woman, he said to her, his eyes glistening as he spoke. Women are born with a natural compassion that men can never really hope to have. His head dropped to his chest and he sighed. My wife left me 8 months ago. We're separated and she's not coming back. She's a lot younger than I am. She's your age. We were both very unhappy. We fought constantly. She can't handle the attention I've been getting since the book. It's for the best. I don't have many friends. I guess I'm pretty lonely. She didn't know what to say to him, so she said nothing. He got up, walked across the room, and put some money in the jukebox. A song came on. She recognized it immediately. Percy Mayfield, Please Send Me Someone to Love. He came back to the table and extended his hand to her. Will you dance with me? She hesitated a minute and then slipped off her high heels, discreetly, she hoped, under the table. On the dance floor, he held her close, one hand at the small of her back. They swayed to the music and he looked at her deeply, meaningfully. She thought she could feel him bump against her thigh. She waited for him to speak. You know, he said, I have black relatives. Oh, brother, she thought to herself. Maybe I'm just not hearing this right.
Oh, that's great. That's Nicole Panther reading the title, an excerpt of the title story of her collection, Mr. Right On. He has the greatest pickup line, I have to say. I'd love to talk politics with you.
There's a lot of those guys out there.
Have you met people who've tried to pick you up with a line like that?
And been successful.
No, why would that?
Sadly enough.
Why would that work on you?
Well, not recently, but years back. You know, you're young and naive and you think they want to get to know you for your brains.
If you don't mind my skipping ahead and giving away some of the ending here, I'll say that he does successfully pick her up and they have days and nights of passionate lovemaking. And then he goes back to his wife and leaves her with a monster bladder infection. And I thought, not very often that you'll find that at the end of a short story about passionate lovemaking.
Well, I guess in real life you might, though.
Exactly. Oh, I was interested in your choice of putting that in.
I taking this sort of glaze off the romance, you know, the mist off the romance, the things I like to write about are things that could happen in real life. And a bladder infection is just as likely as three kids in a house with a picket fence.
Nicole, there's something that I find really interesting and paradoxical about your work. On the one hand, you're really involved in a lot of political activities. I'm just going to list some of the groups that you've been involved with. You co-founded the Bohemian Women's Political Alliance. You've been with the Coalition for Reproductive Rights, the Wednesday Morning Coalition for Peace and Justice in El Salvador, ACT UP, the Homeless Writers Coalition, the Women's Action Coalition, the Haitian Refugee Center. You also write a lot of, you might call it erotica or pornography, whichever. You've been, I think, a stripper. You've done phone sex. So you're this just amazing mix of political and politically incorrect.
I guess so. I think, first of all, you have to have a sense of humor about everything, life included, injustice included. Otherwise, it becomes unbearably sad. And I think when I was really little, I decided that I wanted to have adventures and be an adventuress. And I guess I'm kind of succeeding in that. I do believe that sex work is something that is tremendously empowering to women if they are the ones who benefit from it financially. I certainly wouldn't have been able to do the creative things I'd done unless I danced.
You were very involved in the Los Angeles punk scene in the 1970s. You even managed one of the bands, The Germs. Do you see your writing connecting to the punk music of that period?
Yeah, I see it very much like the dynamic of punk back then, the thing that was so exciting about it. And I have to say that it was, for all its hard edge weirdness, it was fun and funny and one of the best times I've ever had in my life. The do-it-yourself dynamic, if people didn't know necessarily how to play an instrument, that didn't stop them from picking it up and learning how to play it while on stage over a period of months or years. If a record company was not interested in a band, that didn't stop a band from putting out its own record and distributing it itself. And I've kind of taken, there's a whole bunch of us writers who kind of took from that ethos and went ahead and wrote whether or not anyone wanted to put it out for us. And I put little books out myself for a few years. As soon as I had enough material for a book, 100 pages or so, I'd go down to the Xerox machine or whatever corporation I was working at the time. We'd go into the Xerox room and do myself some midnight Xeroxing and go home and staple the books together and go around to bookstores and sell them.
My guest is Nicole Panter. Her new collection of short stories is called Mr. Right On and Other Stories. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicole Panter. You have a piece about punk rock in your new collection, Mr. Right On, that has to do with the emotional connection you felt you made to punk rock and to the other people involved with the music. I want you to read a short excerpt of that.
Okay. There's no need to explain the way this music, this noise makes you feel. There's no need to explain why, when you get dressed every day, you do everything you can to make yourself look as ugly on the outside as you feel on the inside. There's no need to explain your hurt or your anger or the damage you feel, because it is perfectly self-explanatory in this place, in this music.
Did you feel when you discovered punk music that you were finding this community of people that you didn't know existed?
Well, there were five of us in L.A. When I first realized I was a punk. There were probably about four or five, maybe 20 other people. Yeah, and we were like the leper colony. It was a lot of really overly bright kids from overly dysfunctional families.
Would you describe the band that you eventually managed, The Germs?
Well, they weren't exactly a musical experience. It was more of... they became, and are, I mean, their record has never gone out of print. It's still available at any record store at Tower Records or anywhere like that. It was anarchy on stage. It was like watching something fall apart, and in pretty short order. I mean, it would take maybe 10 minutes for the set to fall apart, and after that, anything went. And it was kind of exciting and adrenaline-inducing. And it was also, you know, for me as, like, you know, an 18-year-old band manager trying to take my job seriously, really frustrating. I would just stand at the side of the stage and cry, oh, why can't they do a whole set? Which is not to say that it all went by me, because, I mean, I kind of got what was going on. But in a way, the legend of the Germs wears a lot better than the reality would have.
What was it like for you as a woman in that world?
Well, actually, women, and a lot of other women I know from back then will agree, the scene was populated with powerful women and actually sort of weaker guys. There was a lot of strength amongst the women, amongst the girls. We kind of called the shots.
You know, in your piece about punk and Mr. Right On, you write about making yourself as ugly on the outside as you feel on the inside. Is that the way you saw the fashion statement, so to speak, of punk?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of us came from all of us came from pretty dysfunctional homes. And a lot of us went through adolescence being outcast, you know. I definitely wasn't the prom queen where I grew up. And I think the attitude was, well, okay, I'm going to shove this back at you. This is what you made me, and now you're going to have to look at it. At least that was my feeling.
You've talked about how you felt you and a lot of the other people in punk music were smart people from really dysfunctional families. What was your family like?
Really weird. Eccentric. My dad was this guy named Pat Oliveri, and he basically invented the Philadelphia cheesesteak sandwich and made a lot of money from it, moved his family to the desert in California, and he owned a world champion light heavyweight boxer when I was growing up. And so my parents were always going off to boxing matches. My mother was always dressed in sables and diamonds and all of that. And there was a lot of that. It was kind of a violent household. My mother was about 30 years younger than my father. And while it seemed glamorous and somewhat eccentric from the outside, it was pretty rough on the inside. And I guess I was an iconoclast from the minute I popped out of the womb, because I was always getting in trouble and, you know, always running away. And I finally did run away when I was 14 and didn't go back.
But here you were always getting in trouble, and yet it wasn't like you were from a family that was of the straight-laced middle-class variety. I mean, your father sounds like he had one foot in the underworld anyways.
Well, yeah, but he was always threatening me with convent school. It was always, he would always say, do as I say, not as I do. And my mother was like his fifth wife or something like that. And it was kind of hypocritical and weird. And a lot of people were afraid of my dad because he was a frightening figure. It was strange. We were basically raised by a lot of really nice, sympathetic, hired people.
Of servants?
Who tried to protect us from my father's temper as much as they could. But after a certain point, you know, I was always really strong-willed, and so I just left.
Did you have any sense of where you were going?
Yeah, I went further into the Coachella Valley, and I actually worked in the fields for a little while because I knew they would look for me in Hollywood.
Did you leave a note behind?
No, I didn't want to go back.
Did they find you?
No. A few years later, I'd heard that my father died, and I went back to visit. And it was still really strange. I don't get along with my family.
Do you speak with them?
No.
So when did you start building a viable life for yourself? I mean, you were really young to be on your own.
Yeah, but I sort of learned survival skills early.
Doing what?
Dodging my father. You know, dodging flying objects.
Oh, I see. You mean in the house. Places. Back
yeah,
in your
yeah.
home.
Yeah.
So, but where did you stay as a 14-year-old on your own?
Well, at the time, and it was the early 70s, there were, like, hippies and people in vans and, you know, and you just figure out what the coin of the realm is and you either deal with it or disappear.
So you were a street kid for a while?
For a little while, yeah. Yeah, but because of a lot of things, I was always able, I didn't have a problem working really hard. And I was really sort of canny about what I had to do to survive and still be within my limits of morality and decency.
No, it seems like most of your life you've been like on the artistic fringes.
Yeah.
I don't mean on the fringes of artistry, but among the struggle of artists who are always on the fringes because what they're doing is considered too radical or subversive or underground or whatever. When did you realize that that's what you were going to gravitate to, whether it was music or writing?
When I was about 3, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I maybe a little older than that, but not much. I was always artistic and an outcast, but, you know, also part of, you know, one of the contrary answers to that is some of the people that were part of that have gone on to make enormous, enormous sums of money. Matt Groening, who went on to do The Simpsons, you know, practically lived on my couch for 3 years. He was my husband's best friend. And no one thought that he was ever going to amount to anything.
Does that make you wish that you had found something that was really commercial?
No, I'm happy. Believe it or not, I'm happy, I'm artistically fulfilled. I lead an exciting, fun, interesting life. I don't know that money has solved the problems that a lot of people I knew were having who've made money.
Nicole Panter, her new book, Mr. Right On and Other Stories, is published by Incommunicado Press. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the United States' shifting policy on Bosnia?
We're going to analyze that shifting policy, Terry, and talk to some experts about what it means. We also have the Supreme Court argument on term limits today. Nina Totenberg will have a report. And the debate on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade starts today in the House of Representatives. We'll talk about tax cuts with the coming chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and budget cuts with a member of the president's economic advisors. Also, we'll have a little piece on being a lame duck.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the past year, it's likely that the way Madonna has been best remembered is for her foul-mouthed appearance on The David Letterman Show. Now she's back with her 7th album. It's called Bedtime Stories, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Madonna is our foremost artist of the obvious, and I mean that as a compliment. It takes nerve, talent, and skill to invest clichés with new vividness and power, and that's what Madonna does throughout Bedtime Stories. The album title suggests more of the same old in-and-out fantasizing she did on her last collection, Erotica, as well as that naughty book she released at the same time. Does anyone out there still have a copy of Sex on his or her coffee table? 2 years ago, Madonna was intent on making the blatant seem like a revelation. This time around, she's decided that there's something to be said for simple, unadorned beauty.
Take a bow, the night is over, this masquerade is getting older. Lights are low, the curtain's down.
That's Take a Bow, a bit of luscious R&B that Madonna co-wrote with the great producer Babyface. Bedtime Stories represents a return to her roots in dance music after a misbegotten romance with pop. In song after song here, what pulls you in are the slinky rhythms. On the title tune, she chants, "Let's get unconscious, honey," and her intent is very clear. Surrender to the rhythm and a kind of cultural and emotional wisdom will be yours. When I saw Madonna spewing four-letter words at David Letterman a while back, I really thought she'd lost it. Critics often speak of artists being out of touch with their audience, but this was the most literal, dramatic example of this that I can think of. Madonna entered to cheers and exited to boos. Like so many other people, I thought her unwarranted hostility and adolescent cursing made her look bad. But listening to Bedtime Stories, I'm ready to eat some crow. At the very least, you have to hand it to Madonna for rejecting the smug air of irony that pervades so much pop culture these days, including David Letterman. And at her best, she's managing to find ways of making stating the obvious sound like the subtlest stuff a singer can attempt.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Madonna's new album, Bedtime Stories. And if you want to see the made-for-TV version of Madonna's life, tune into Fox Tonight for Innocence Lost. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Barbara Bogave and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Things haven't been the same since you came into my life. You found a way to touch my soul. And I'm never, ever, ever gonna let it go. Happiness lies in your own hand. It took me much too long to understand how it could be until you shared your secret with me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.